Our next oral argument this morning is, I hope I pronounced this correctly, El Said versus Roble. As all counsel are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief. Respondent will have 15 minutes, then finally the appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. So whenever counsel for the appellant is ready, just approach the microphone and begin by telling us who you are in a loud voice, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. Do you mind if I use my computer?
Fine. Go right ahead.
Sure. I have a printout if the court prefers.
I think we've got the briefs, so.
Certainly.
Go right ahead, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. James Godwin on behalf of appellant Abdi Roble. In this case, the district court abused its discretion in two ways. First, the district court applied the wrong law in two instances. Second, the court's findings were unsupported by the record. There are two ways that the court can find a violation of the harassment statute found at 609.748 subdivision 1A. The first is a single instance of a physical assault. The second is repeated instances of acts, words, or gestures that cause, quote, or are intended to cause, quote, a substantial adverse effect on the safety, security, or privacy of another. We will address the physical aspect first. The district court applies the wrong definition of assault. There are two definitions of assault in the criminal statute found at Minnesota Statute Section 609.224, Subdivision 1. The first is a fear assault where the defendant commits an act which causes or intends to cause fear in another of immediate bodily harm. That is the definition that the district court used in the findings, saying that there was an assault committed because the appellant caused the respondent to fear. We do note that there's no finding that there was fear of immediate bodily harm, but I digress. This court has made it very clear in the Peterson case that of those two definitions, the court must apply the second definition, which requires intentional infliction or attempt to inflict bodily harm upon another.
Let me ask you a question. In the respondent's brief at page 10, he cites to document number 25 and the transcript at pages 46 and 84, and we've reviewed those, and it shows that your client was one of the individuals who was pushing and shoving respondent to keep him from entering the mosque. Do you agree that's in the record?
We agree that that testimony was in the record. It's also contradicted in the record, and I'll discuss that as well. And the court did not find it. It's not in her findings that these particular facts I find to be true. And that's not surprising. And the reason is, while the respondent says that Mr. Roble hit him three times, that wasn't in his affidavit. It was not on the video that showed the incident. It wasn't mentioned to the police. Respondents' witnesses agreed that the video shows that appellant had in one hand a cup of coffee and the other hand a phone, never put either of them down to be able to hit the respondent. In addition, the testimony is
Judge, I'm looking at page 2 of the judge's order, and she found that there are reasonable grounds that your client committed the following acts. By making him reasonably fear bodily harm by blocking the entrance to the mosque and by threatening him as he tried to enter the mosque while using his body to prevent him from entering the mosque.
That's exactly right. And that definition, reasonably fear, is the wrong definition of assault. The Peterson case makes clear that reasonable fear doesn't work. You have to have a physical assault.
Well, he was using his body to prevent also.
Okay, so he said that he was standing there and using his body to prevent. The respondent admits that he was never in fear because he wasn't able to enter the mosque. In addition, the respondent admitted on cross-examination that he wasn't being assaulted. When asked, you just testified a few minutes ago that you don't know who assaulted you. Is that correct? His response was, I wasn't being assaulted, but they blocked me not to get inside. And there's no indication that this, in the statute or the Peterson case or any subsequent case, that simply standing somewhere,
Does the record indicate that when asked if Robles struck or hit him, Mahmoud responded, of course, that's what happened from him?
That is one of the things that he testified to, in addition to testifying that he never put down his phone or coffee, in addition to testifying that he wasn't being assaulted. That's why it's no wonder that the district court didn't put that in the findings, because it was severely contradicted by the videographic evidence and by other testimony. What really matters is what makes it into those findings. Now, respondent...
Counsel, why don't these two findings that Judge Riley referred to on page 2 of the judge's order constitute the second part of the harassment definition, which are repeated incidents of intrusive or unwanted acts or words, when you take those two things together?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Now, the court didn't find that. The court found that there were two threats. The court doesn't use, the order does not say that the district court found a substantial adverse effect on safety, security, or privacy, or any of those words. Rather, the district court uses the word threat. Now, here's why that's problematic.
Let me ask you this question, because you seem to be arguing that because the district court didn't use the exact words of the statute, that it's reversible error.
Not exactly that the court didn't use the exact words, but didn't use any of the words or synonyms for the words.
Well, if I disagree with that characterization, do you have any case law that supports that argument?
I believe Peterson supports that argument.
That you have to use exact words or close approximations? Would that be, am I paraphrasing your argument accurately?
I suppose I don't have a specific case on that, but the general principle, I suppose, is that the court has to apply the statute. And if the court doesn't apply the statute, but applies something different, then the statute hasn't been violated, or at least the order hasn't shown that the statute was violated. What the district court does say is fear of bodily harm, but not, as Peterson requires, actual contact initiated by the appellant. Second of all, the word threat doesn't get you there, and here's why. The word threat is, number one, very vague, and the facts that the court actually said were threats. Number one, she says that there was evidence, or that the record supported the contention that appellant said, watch your back. That is not in the record. You can search the word watch, search the word back. You're not going to find that in the record. What you're going to find is that respondent says that the appellant approached him in the restroom, spoke to him in a language he didn't understand, but he did understand certain swear words, and he understood the phrase, you're going to see, I'm going to show you what is going to happen to you when we're done. He did not testify that even he understood that to be a threat. So what's the problem with the word threat? Was a huge problem.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that spitting someone on someone is a physical assault?
It may be, Your Honor, but again, the court did not find that. If you check out the findings, they simply don't say that that the spitting occurred. It's one of the many things that, while the respondent alleged them, after watching the video and hearing the testimony, the court didn't put that in the findings. And we think that's crucial. Because you can't just take anything that someone testified to in the record and import it into the findings, even if it was contradicted, especially in this case by videographic evidence.
Everything was videographed.
Not all of it was, but there was nothing on that that showed any spitting. In addition, because of the contradictory record, the only way to know what the judge actually credited is not to say, well, the party that won gets every bit of evidence they put in. The question is, what did the judge put in the findings? Because it's very conspicuously absent that she didn't say appellant hit respondent. If she did that, we wouldn't be here. It would be done. But she didn't find that he hit him, three times or otherwise. The district court could have said appellant spat upon respondent. But the district court didn't find that. Presumably, she would have put those key facts in there if she found them to be true, and she did not find them to be true. And we don't believe that it's this court's prerogative to go into the record and pick out things that the district court didn't find credible enough to put in her findings to ultimately support the order. Now, here's why the word threat isn't enough. Not only is it not in the statute, but this court has recently held in State versus Jorgensen, which is 934 Northwest 2nd, 362, that if a statute were to make a threat impermissible, that statute is unconstitutionally overbroad. This court struck down the state's coercion statute, which prohibits making threats. And the reasoning was the word threat doesn't mean threat of physical harm or threat of financial ruin. It could be anything from telling someone if they don't drop out of a political race, then their extramarital affair will be exposed.
But counsel, the definition of harassment, again, going to the second prong, are repeated incidents of intrusive or unwanted acts, words, or gestures. So words are clearly in there. What does that mean in that statute, words?
Because after that it says those words have to cause a substantial adverse effect on safety, security, or privacy. Judge doesn't say any of those.
Well, but the testimony here was certainly that that the incident both blocking and the restroom had a substantial adverse effect on him.
Well, I don't believe
that he felt threatened.
He indicated that he didn't feel threatened by Mr. Robel just standing there, except for this. This is what the record supports for the threats. I think this is important. The judge didn't find that Mr. Robel intended to cause fear. The record does support that he was afraid, but this is a crucial distinction. The record doesn't support that he was afraid because of anything Mr. Robel did. The reason he said he was afraid of Mr. Robel is he's not a decent guy. He doesn't respect anyone.
Well, in the March 12th incident, he certainly suggested that it was something Mr. Robel did, and that the gesture and the words.
I think that may be accurate, Your Honor. If it is, that's only one instance. And if you don't have physical, you have to have repeated. And there's absolutely no evidence that the first instance, with multiple people at the doorway of the masjid, there was anything that Mr. Robel did. There was some testimony that there was a suggestion that he hit the respondent. Respondent then admitted he wasn't being assaulted. Mr. Robel never put down his coffee or his phone to be able to assault him. Didn't tell the police that, didn't put it in his affidavit. It makes a lot of sense. The district court said, I don't believe you. Now, she didn't put that in her findings, as they rarely do. But because those findings don't contain any finding of actual physical assault, you need to have repeated instances. And there's no evidence that Mr. Robel did anything to cause fear on that first instance at the masjid. The testimony was that he was standing there and that the respondent was afraid of him because he doesn't respect anyone, and he's not a decent person. Not that Mr. Robel made a move towards him, none of that. So, and crucially, with the testimony all over the place, 3 days of trial, contradictions, videos that people disagreed with, the court was able to make limited findings. And if you look at what the court's findings are, they are that there was an assault based on fear, which Peterson says doesn't work, and there were threats, which is not in the statute, and there's no citation in the order to any particular thing that was a threat, particular words that were a threat, what was threatened.
Unwanted words or gestures, threats.
Well, not all unwanted word or gesture is a threat. For example, it could be an insult. And insults aren't actionable under the harassment statute.
But the judge did find that they were threatening.
She found threat, but she didn't say she found a substantial adverse effect of safety, security, or privacy of another. Let me give you an example of the better way to read the confrontation in the bathroom. Mr. Robel never said, I'm going to hurt you. He said, even if you take the testimony of the respondent as true, and that somehow he began to understand this foreign language just for the purpose of understanding this alleged threat, easily that could be, I'm going to appeal this order. To read anything more into it, it would have been simple for the court to say, Mr. Robel said, I'm going to hurt you, or something along those lines. It's not what happened. The court said that, well, that was a threat. Doesn't explain how it was a threat, doesn't explain what words were used. What the court does say that she found to be a threat is watch your back, which may be too vague anyway, but it is not in the record. So the one thing that the judge found that could have been a threat, which again wouldn't have been a repeated word, was only on in that second instance, and that alleged threat isn't in the record at all. I think it's very important to look at what the testimony was with regard to the incident at the masjid, because it's very clear that Mr. Robel had something in his hands, was not able to physically instigate any contact with the respondent, and the suggestion that he threatened them just by being there is not in the findings. It's just the word threat is there, but no actual facts of what he said. You know, if you do X, I'm going to do Y. are not in there. And that's far too vague for this court to even review. And we believe that's one of the major problems, because as the residences that at Jewell case holds, if the district court must make specific findings as to allegations of harassment before it may issue a restraining order, and points out that the findings are required in order to permit meaningful review upon appeal. So right now, we're speculating as to what the judge may have meant for threat, what facts may have supported that, whether it might have been a physical threat, a litigation threat, we don't know. That's exactly the problem with this order, and that's the reason that this court should reverse the order. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent, please.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Ken Schuler. I'm an attorney from Rochester, and I represent Imam El-Sayed Mahmoud. The standard of review for this case is abuse of discretion. And in looking through the arguments of the appellant, and by the way, I was the attorney who handled all 3 days of the hearing and have actually represented the mosque for several years. One of the things we wanted to do was give you some context for what was going on, and there have been struggles with that mosque. It's right downtown. It's right across the street or kitty corner from the new Hilton downtown if you ever get to Rochester. One of the things that we've been working on very hard is to establish a structure within the community for resolving disputes, which is really what led to this confrontation that occurs on February 10th of last year. And then also to try to control the interactions of the members of the mosque so we don't have people getting spit on, threatened, pushed around, that type of thing. I believe the video of what happened, or at least one of the videos, every time we have an incident like this, everybody pulls up their cell phone and we get multiple angles, actually, of what occurred. But I think in the record, if you care to, you can see what occurred at least from one of the perspectives. Also, I think the court may have taken the Olmsted County Sheriff's Office video from the government center and included that as an exhibit, showing the people coming in and out of the restroom on the second day of the hearing, March 12th, which the imam testified to at the hearing. Mr. Robley did not testify at the hearing regarding the incident. He took the Fifth Amendment. This all happens in the context of trying to organize the group, avoid conflict, and then we've got this arbitration panel that's made up of three people that have agreed to coming down to Rochester, trying to have a second day of hearings to resolve the conflict within the mosque, and then this group that stands in front of the door trying to stop our folks from getting in to have the hearing, trying to disrupt the arbitration, and Mr. Robley is the tallest person there, standing in front of the door. And you may have also seen that the imam had some history with Mr. Robley and was threatened by him immediately when he saw him in front of the door, or felt threatened by him. That's what he testified to. One other quick thing I wanted to point out, too, is you've got different languages at this hearing, and we have interpreters. So, for example, the imam's first language is Arabic. And he speaks pretty good English, but not to the point that he doesn't need an interpreter. Mr. Robley's first language is Somali. He does not speak Arabic, but he speaks pretty good English as well. He may or may not have needed an interpreter. I don't recall. And so when you're going through the transcript, you're getting, as best as we can, an interpreter explaining what someone is testifying to. And there were times when the imam was testifying in English as to what happened, and there were times when he was working through an interpreter. So just to give you some background on that as well. And that's something that the judge had to sift through at the hearing to try to work through that as best she could. The findings of the court, it's not my understanding that the findings of the court have to be so specific as counsel is requiring. There are sufficient findings by the court, both factually and legally, to support the issuance of the restraining order in this case. And you've got it in front of you. I can tell you that the testimony regarding the spitting incident, which is not referenced in the court's decision. That's something that occurs off video later on. It was testified to by other people. It was unrebutted that Mr. Robley spit on the imam. The whole issue about what happens in front of the door, you can see it pretty well on the video. The imam was injured as a result of it. He saw a doctor. He was bruised as a result of what occurred. Mr. Robley is definitely part and parcel to that. I know he claims his hands are full at the time, but it seemed to me that there was certainly a basis for concluding that at a minimum he was blocking the door and was physically pushing back against the imam. Whether or not he actually caused the bruising, it's not clear from the melee that occurred. There was a threat, and I don't think that's refuted by Mr. Robley. And if you look, again, if you look at the video, there's some people are speaking English, some are speaking Arabic, many are speaking Somali at the time, and it's not exactly clear what threats there were and who's saying what. And then, of course, we have the whole incident on March 12th of 2019, which I was deeply involved in. And I saw the imam's white face when he came back from the restroom as we were about to start the afternoon session of the hearing. And he told me what happened, which I absolutely couldn't believe. And I looked at the video with the judge and Mr. Robley's lawyer, and it certainly seemed to me that was a setup to get the imam in the bathroom. And I think Mr. Robley got a signal from another person who was there and then shot into the bathroom and absolutely threatened the imam, cursed at him, at least using English curse words. And without a doubt, it was intended to cause an immediate fear of bodily harm, and it absolutely did. It worked. The imam was very scared, and then we had to take a side road at the hearing and have just testimony about that issue alone on the 12th before we finished up, I believe, on March 26th. So the record clearly supports issuance of restraining order in this case. It was absolutely needed in this case. It's had the desired effect at the mosque, and the judge was well within her discretion to do what she did. In fact, I would say it came to the point of almost a common sense analysis of what it takes under these circumstances to try to make sure that people at least deal with each other in a civil manner with some level of comity and not in the manner that was used in this case. So we ask that you affirm the district court decision.
Thank you, counsel. Finally, we'll hear from counsel for the appellant on rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel and court. Your honors, we believe that, as we indicated before, there are two things that absolutely have to appear in the judge's findings to allow this court to review them. What exactly did she find was a physical assault, if she found one, which she didn't, and what exactly, what words or actions or gestures caused a substantial effect on the safety, security, or privacy of another. We think it requires a great deal of reading in to get there. We do agree that this is a dispute about the governance of the masjid. It is not something that has implicated the violation of the harassment statute. Frankly, if a similar incident occurred again, then perhaps we would have repeated incidents, and we presume that that Mr. Robel knows that, and these instances are in the past. What's important is the order before this court simply does not support a harassment restraining order. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We will now be in recess until our final oral argument by ITV.